You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. In this podcast, Dahlia Lithwick, a renowned journalist and expert on the Supreme Court, addresses such questions as what health care reform cases will be coming up in this important election year, and what other major cases are in the pipeline. Ms. Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate Magazine, and in that capacity writes the Supreme Court Dispatches and Jurisprudence columns. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The Washington Post, and Commentary, among other publications. She received the Online News Association's Award for Online Commentary in 2001 and again in 2005 for a series she co-authored on torture. Ms. Lithwick spoke at the Wednesday, February 8, 2012 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Grace Zisk.
I'm sure most of you know that our usual format is that we don't have questions until after the speaker is finished. But after that, we will have plenty of time for your questions, so please hold them until then. It's my pleasure today to introduce Dahlia Lithwick, who is a renowned journalist and expert on the Supreme Court. Dahlia is a senior editor at Slate, and in that capacity writes the Supreme Court Dispatches and Jurisprudence columns. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The Washington Post, and Commentary, among other publications. She received the Online News Association's Award for Online Commentary in 2001 and again in 2005 for a series she co-authored on torture. Dahlia was the first online journalist invited to serve on the steering committee for the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. She was editor of the Best American Legal Writing of 2009 and the co-author of Me Versus Everybody, Absurd Contracts for an Absurd World, a legal humor book. There's humor in legal life? In addition, she has written I Will Sing Life, Voices from the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp, a book about seven children from Paul Newman's camp with life-threatening illnesses. She lives in Charlottesville with her husband and two sons, two young sons. Dahlia.
Thank you so much to Sue and to Grace for inviting me and to all of you for coming out to hear me talk. I'm going to try to leave lots of time for questions because questions are always the best part, and I've heard myself talk before. It's not all that interesting. So what I thought I might do is talk for about a half hour about what is shaping up to be the most extraordinary term at the United States Supreme Court, and then try to take your questions for a half hour, 45 minutes after that, and see how we muddle through. I want to start just by saying that this is a very strange beat that I cover. There's only about 20 of us covering the Supreme Court. Once you get the job of being a Supreme Court correspondent, you stay on it, often for decades. Linda Greenhouse, who covered the court for the New York Times, covered it for 30 years and won some Pulitzers doing it. But it really is, I think, the single greatest beat to have in journalism. And interestingly, I haven't fully explored why this is so. It happens to be a terrific beat for women. Particularly women with young children, so that it's not an accident that the people you hear covering the court, whether it's Linda Greenhouse Greenhouse or Nina Totenberg or Jan Crawford or Marcia Coyle on the NewsHour are all women. It's really unique in politics, which isn't in any way to malign the men who are covering the court, who are also astonishing. But it happens to be a really, really good beat for someone who has small children at home and doesn't want to run out on emergencies at midnight. There are no Supreme Court emergencies, with the exception of Bush v. Gore. And that was before I had my children. So what I thought I would, and also, ironically, I've been covering the court for, this is my 13th term. That still makes me the youngest person on the Supreme Court beat. These, you know, this is just an extraordinary beat of lifers who do it really well. What I thought I would talk about is this paradox that the institution of the court represents. The court is always and will be two things at the same time. So one vision of the court is that it is this lofty, apolitical institution. It's built not accidentally to look like a temple. The justices not accidentally drift around in long black robes. They're meant to be completely interchangeable. For a very long time, until very recently, if you ordered a transcript of the oral argument at the court, it wouldn't say Chief Justice Rehnquist asks a question, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor asks a question. It said the court. You couldn't even figure out from the transcript which justice was talking. And that was part of, I think, this attempt that the court has had since the beginning of history to hold itself out as not a collection of nine political individuals, but people who really are above the political fray and who, you know, answer to a higher authority, in the language of Hebrew National Hot Dogs, who really do the work of interpreting the Constitution separate from, you know, the hoi polloi of what politics is doing. And probably the best expression of that hope for the court is Justice Stephen Breyer, who recently wrote a really interesting book called Making Our Democracy Work, says Americans are wrong to think of the Supreme Court justices as, quote, nine junior varsity politicians. That when we put on our robes, we shed all that. What we're doing is something quite different. Now, the other version of the court, of course, is the much more common one in if you read newspapers or if you are involved in conversations about the court, and that is the court is an eminently political institution. These are political appointments made by political actors for political reasons to achieve political ends, and that anyone who tells you anything different is lying. And what I want to suggest to you, and this is, you know, one way of thinking about this, is the fictional character Mr. Dooley years ago said, the Supreme Court always follows the election returns, that the Supreme Court is first and foremost a political enterprise doing political work. It's just gussied up in black robes to do it. And what I want to suggest to you is that, of course, both those things are completely true. And they're completely not true. And they're true and not true at the same time. And the paradox of the court is that you have to hold these two irreconcilable ideas in your, thank you, Grace. These two irreconcilable ideas in your head at the same time. That you can't think of the court as a purely partisan ideological institution. It's not. If you look at the decisions that come down from the court every term, my God, it takes a village to open my water. Okay. Thank you. Okay, that if you look at the decisions that come down from the court term after term, they are overwhelmingly unanimous. This is not a court that is 5-4, thank you, fractured along ideological lines by any means, and it is a mistake to think that it is. At the same time, this is a very, very political, partisan court. I need only say Bush v. Gore. I need only say Citizens United. I need only say Heller, the gun case, and everybody knows that on hot button issues, this court is quite partisan and quite bitterly divided. So how do we make sense of those two ideas? That's one of the things I want to think about today. And I want to put out there the idea that this term, this coming next couple of weeks, and certainly next year, I think, will be the most bitterly divided that we have seen, certainly since Bush v. Gore, that we are heading into a whirlwind of political questions at the court, more than just the health care cases, but certainly, I think, embodied by the health care cases, and that that is the central tension the Supreme Court has to work out. It has to figure out how to sit and hear these cases and decide these cases, these incredibly hot-button, landmark legal issues that go to the core of American values, and how to figure out a way to represent itself as something that isn't just a political body. And if you think the justices don't worry about this, I assure you that they do. They do worry about appearing partisan. They do worry about looking political. That for years after Bush v. Gore came down, the court, I think, quite overtly ducked hot-button cases because it didn't want to get embroiled back in the fray, that the court was absolutely stunned by the blowback to Citizens United, the campaign finance case that came down 2 years ago, and has tried very, very hard, I think, to manage the outcomes of that case. And I think that, and we're going to bracket the justices' extracurricular activities, which become more interesting every year, and talk about that at the end. But I think if you put aside their extrajudicial conduct, it's very clear that the court is struggling to make sense of the fact that it both wants to be above politics and fundamentally is a very political body. So that's my frame. So I thought I would just talk briefly about the cases that are coming before the court. And I'm sure some of you know some of this and some of you know all of it, but I'm going to just sort of put us all on the same page and then we can talk about what it all means. So believe it or not, in the coming weeks, the court is going to hear some of the most epic cases I have ever covered in my life. One is the healthcare overhaul, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, which will be heard in March and decided by June. One is the Arizona immigration law, the one that has gotten so much attention around the country. One they just heard in December and already ruled on, that was a Texas redistricting case that they've already determined the outcome of. In addition to that, they heard, I think, what is the most important case that has to do with privacy and technology, which is the GPS satellite case that came down last month. In addition to that, there's still a possibility, if that's not all, that the court will hear an affirmative action case out of Texas that will really be the determining case on whether affirmative action in higher education still exists in this country. And in case you weren't watching the news last night, steaming down upon them is a decision that came down yesterday out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals about Proposition 8, the California Anti-Gay Marriage Initiative. And for anyone who didn't follow yesterday's drama, by a 2-1 decision, the Federal Appeals Court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, said that Proposition 8 is unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, there's no chance of that case going to the Supreme Court this term. And in fact, the proponents of Prop 8 still get to decide whether they want to take it back to the Ninth Circuit. They have the option to taking it to an 11-judge panel on the Ninth Circuit. But mark my words, that case or the Defense of Marriage Act cases, which are coming up through the First Circuit, will be in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in the next 2 years. So just to be clear, a court that really tries to hold itself out as apolitical is about to wade in on the president's signature health care law, on the power of states to set their own immigration policy, on the future of the Voting Rights Act, where it comes to redistricting, on technology and the interplay between technology and privacy, oh, and also gay marriage and affirmative action. So if we're missing anything, forgive me, but that is a big, big, big term. And that is just hugely, hugely consequential to the court in terms of holding itself as not a 5-4 court. So what I thought I would do is just briefly talk about those cases and give you a heads up about what you're going to see. Or in this case, not see, because the court will not televise any of them. But you'll certainly read about it the next day. The first thing is the healthcare cases. They will be decided on 3 days. They will be heard on 3 days in March. 4 issues before the court. One issue is the one we all know about. This is the challenge by 26 state attorneys general saying that the Obama healthcare law violates the Commerce Clause, that the Congress cannot force you to purchase health insurance, and that this is an unprecedented use of congressional power. These cases have fared really in an interesting way in the lower courts. They've been upheld in two courts of struck down in two courts of appeals, upheld in one. And the court really does have to grapple with, first and foremost, this issue of whether the mandate, the individual health mandate, as it's called, is unconstitutional. And then they have another problem that they have to deal with, which is this comes up from the court, the federal court in the District of Columbia, that says, here's a way to not decide this case. Let's not decide this case by saying that a 19th century law, the Anti-Injunction Act, actually precludes anyone from challenging this law until they've actually had to pay. So until this becomes operative, says the federal court in D.C., let's just kick this thing down the road until the law goes into effect. And that's one way for the court to not get to this. They're going to hear a whole day on whether the Anti-Injunction Act precludes them from either even hearing the case. Then they have to decide this incredibly technical question once they've decided about the mandate. If they determine that the mandate is unconstitutional, can they separate it from the rest of the law, or does the law fall altogether? So this is this question of severability. Usually courts will say, even if a little provision in the law is unconstitutional, we're going to uphold the rest of the law. But there is some real question about whether the rest of the law could possibly survive if the court strikes down the individual mandate. And so they're going to have to decide this issue of severability, whether they can preserve one chunk of the law if part of it falls. And it sounds boring, but it will be boring. And fourth and finally, they're going to hear an issue that was nowhere decided in the federal appeals court, and that is about the Medicaid expansion and whether the expansion of Medicaid coerces the states into being involved in the Medicaid program. This is an amazing thing that the court reached out and ordered to have briefed. It was not something that the other courts took seriously. So that's 3 days of argument, 5.5 hours of argument in March. And that's the Health Care Act. And I don't need to tell you how hugely consequential this is, that it will be briefed, argued, and decided in an election year. It is really an extraordinary thing. The court had no option but to take this. I think that folks who think, oh, my God, could the court have ducked this for a year, don't understand that when you have three federal circuit courts in conflict, there is no option but to take this case. They had to take it. States have to prepare themselves for this law going into effect. So the court had no option to duck this. All right, that's the health care law. The Arizona immigration case has gotten a ton of press. The provisions, there are four provisions that are going to be scrutinized by the court. Most famously, the part that's called the papers please part of the law, where the police can stop you if they suspect that you're in the country illegally and demand your papers. Three other provisions will also be tested. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has said it's unconstitutional, so the court's going to have to determine now, and this will be heard in April, also decided by June, whether in fact the whole law falls. The issue here is really one of congressional power, very similar issue to the healthcare case. The Constitution expressly gives Congress, not the states, the power to set, quote, uniform rules of naturalization. And so Congress takes the position, the Obama administration takes the position, that states can't go out and enact their own immigration laws, and that this is something that is properly left to the Congress. That's the issue, and that will be argued, as I said, in April. Arizona has really painted this as a states' rights case, has said, in effect, the federal government has done nothing about immigration, which is true. Congress has been worse than useless, so we're going to enact our own laws, and don't tell us what we can and can't do in Arizona. It is a straight-on federalism question, not all that different, by the way, than the federalism questions at the heart of the healthcare cases. Okay, this brings us to Texas redistricting. Unbelievably technical case that comes out of Texas. In effect, the Voting Rights Act has said that states that have a history of discrimination have to get changes in their voting policies pre-cleared with the Justice Department. And Texas is one of those states. Texas has redistricted. They get four extra congressional seats, and they redistrict and they draw needless to say, we all know what happens when states redistrict: self-serving, self-interested, crazy-looking maps. And the maps do not get approved in time, and so Texas is staring down the barrel of an election with no maps, except they have maps, because they have one map that the Republican legislature has drawn, they have one map that a federal court has drawn, and the Supreme Court has to decide, with an election looming, which map they're going to use. Well, the Supreme Court, not surprisingly, and this Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, has been very dubious about the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act. Not surprisingly, the Roberts Court kicked it back to Texas and said, you cannot use the judge-made maps. You have to defer to the Republican legislature and the maps that they drew. This is a signal moment in terms of raising questions about the validity of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, going forward. This brings us to the GPS case. This was a fantastically interesting and fun case to watch. For those of us who think that the court has really dodged high-tech cases, they just don't know what to do with them. Famously, I was covering a case called Kwan a couple of years ago that had to do with pagers. And the justices were so flummoxed by the modern technology that they were asking questions of the oral advocates like, now, does a pager talk to a satellite in the sky? And everyone was laughing, and the clerks were all going, oh, my God. And, you know, that case ended up being, it was an incredibly important privacy case, and the court just punted. And the court really just said, essentially, this is just too complicated for us to draw bright lines about what is and is not permitted. And I think a lot of us thought the GPS case was going to go that way. The GPS essentially involves the federal, the state police affixing a GPS device to a suspected drug dealer's car. They have no warrant. They had a warrant. They didn't do it when they had a warrant. Also, they had a warrant in Maryland, not in D.C., so they had a bad warrant. And then they follow a drug dealer around using this GPS tracking system for weeks. And lo and behold, he's a drug dealer, and he has a lot of money in a drug stash house. And so he goes to jail for a very long time. And the Supreme Court has to determine whether this is a violation of his privacy rights, of his right to not be searched without probable cause and a warrant. And the Supreme Court really does a spectacular job of boning up on what GPS technology is. And they have one of the best oral arguments I've ever seen. And they determine that, in fact, the police cannot affix a GPS to your car without a warrant. Very, very different rationales. Justice Scalia, speaking for four justices, writes an opinion saying it's a trespass on your property to affix something to your car. Justice Alito, speaking for other four justices, says it's clearly a violation of the warrant requirement, period. They've intruded into your vehicle. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor writes a really compelling sky-is-falling fifth opinion that attaches itself to Justice Alito, but essentially says, oh my God, people, the GPSs are so yesterday. There are cameras on every street corner. The government is collecting all your information on Google. You don't want to be worried about GPSs. You want to be worried about Big Brother, and it's really scary, and everybody nods and doesn't listen to her. But I think that Justice Sotomayor, in this sense, has the right of it, that the problem is the Supreme Court is always fighting the last war, and technology is changing so quickly that it's actually very heartening to have a justice at the court who's really in a well-placed panic about it. That case comes down. I should add one other case that I didn't mention that is not hugely consequential for my sort of illustrative purposes, but hugely funny, is a case that the court has heard and not yet decided about fleeting expletives on television. So this is a case that is hugely, hugely fun to cover. The question is that the FCC has always allowed people at awards shows to swear spontaneously. They bleep it out, no harm, no foul. Suddenly there's a couple of people getting up, notably Cher, I think, at awards shows and dropping the F-bomb and the S-bomb. And the FCC decides to penalize them, and the question is whether they can appropriately change their policy, whether it's an infringement of First Amendment free speech rights. I tell you all this background to tell you that somehow sloughed into this case has come up to the Supreme Court, gone back to the appeals court, come up again to the Supreme Court, and somehow added into this case now is a policy that has to do not just with fleeting expletives, which are funny on their own right, but bare buttocks, which are even funnier. And so it seems that NYPD Blue had made a practice for a while of showing bare buttocks on television. Who knew? And this was part of the FCC new crackdown on indecency, was going to be that they couldn't do that anymore. And I tell you this story not because it's a hugely consequential case, but that I've been covering the court for 12 and a half years, and I have never seen an oral advocate get up and do what Seth Waxman, representing Fox Television, did, which is look up to the friezes around the court. You know where this is going, right? And he goes, Justice Scalia, there are bare buttocks there, and also buttocks here, and also buttocks there. And everyone was gobsmacked, not the least of which was Justice Scalia, who was... So I don't know how that case comes down. It's an incredibly doctrinally very, very thorny case because it involves overruling a signal case called Pacifica that the court, I think, has to overrule to get to the merits on this. But I just told you that so I could say buttocks a bunch of times. So this brings us to Texas affirmative action. So, right, that's not all. The court is now dealing with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. They're dealing with the health care law. They're dealing with Arizona immigration. They're dealing with bare buttocks. And now there's a very distinct possibility. I don't think they will take it for this year, although there is some urgency to take it. But there is an affirmative action case out of Texas that really wants to re-raise the questions that were not quite solved in the Michigan affirmative action cases a few years ago. That was when Justice O'Connor was on the court before Justice Alito took her place, really calling into question whether affirmative action in higher education will continue to exist as we know it, and that there's an enormous amount of pressure on the court to take that case. And then finally, yesterday, handed all wrapped up in a bow to the Supreme Court, is the issue of gay marriage, which is an issue that I assure you they do not want to hear in an election year, for all the reasons you might suspect. Now, I don't think this case gets to the court until after the election, but I think it will very much inform the conversation about the role of judges and justices in deciding basic civil rights / morality issues. And just briefly to tell you what happened yesterday, in 2008, the California Supreme Court announced that there was a right for same-sex couples to marry under the Constitution. 18,000 couples in California availed themselves of that right for several months until the Prop 8 initiative in November of 2008 announced that by a margin of 52% to 48%, the California voters wanted to take that right away. They were going to amend the California Constitution, limiting marriage to heterosexual couples. Here's where it gets interesting. A case is brought by the two lions of Bush v. Gore, David Boies, who represented Al Gore, and Ted Olson, who represented Bush. Olson went on to become the Solicitor General in the Bush administration. And these two guys get together and defend two gay couples in California who wish to be married. And they put on really one of the most interesting cases I have ever seen about testing the question of whether there is at heart that Proposition 8 reflected an anti-gay rights animus. Was it because we just don't like gay couples? Because if that was what motivated the California referendum, it is unconstitutional. As you may recall, in August of 2010, a federal judge, Vaughn Walker, said, yes, it's unconstitutional. It is unconstitutional to ban gay marriage. He did so in a very sweeping opinion. Yesterday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, voting 2-1, said that he was right. Now, they were very careful to limit his opinion. What they said sounded to me an awful like, believe it or not, Bush v. Gore. What they said was, if you're in a state that says that gay marriage is okay, and then people get married, and then you take it away, like Lucy with the football, well, that's unconstitutional. So the folks in Maryland, the folks in Washington State, all the people who wanted a pronouncement from a high federal court about the right to gay marriage did not get that yesterday. The people in California yesterday did get the announcement that Prop 8 is unconstitutional and gay marriage is constitutionally protected. Now, that decision is stayed so that nobody is running out to get married in San Francisco today. That will be stayed until the Supreme Court hears it. But it directly presents to the Supreme Court an issue that the Supreme Court cannot duck. Now, I think this means, and I may be wrong, that within the year, the Supreme Court will hear this case, and there's a real question about whether this is the best test case for these issues, but now it's before the court. So I've talked a little bit about what the court is facing, and I can, if you want me to, predict what I think will happen. But what I strongly think, as a way of thinking about all of these huge blockbuster issues, is that it's important to remember that the healthcare litigation, the one that everybody's attention is focused on, is not the Supreme Court's big issue. The way this case has been framed in the radio, on television, in water cooler conversations, has been about freedom. And it's been framed as, can the government coerce you to do something you don't want to do? But if you'll remember from my summary of the issues, that's not one of the issues in the case. This is not a case testing freedom. The idea that the government is regulating inactivity is not an issue that emerges in the briefing in this case. So this is a really interesting case that is being litigated in the public, in one sense, quite differently at the Supreme Court. And I think, I may be wrong, that with the exception of Clarence Thomas, who really does care about these issues of freedom and libertarianism, that this isn't something that Chief Justice Roberts or even Justice Alito really worries about. Justice Scalia is really in trouble with the healthcare cases because he wrote a definitive opinion a few years back about medical marijuana in California. He said, even if you want to grow your tiny little pot plant in California, it implicates interstate commerce. It implicates the Commerce Clause. And so he's really stuck, in a sense, because now he's got to say that the choice to buy healthcare or not healthcare doesn't implicate interstate commerce, but your little pot plant in your kitchen window does. And that's a tough thing to put space between. So Scalia's a little bit stuck. I think that the Chief Justice is a little bit stuck based on what he's written in prior cases. But more profoundly, I just don't think that the healthcare litigation is a set of issues that the Supreme Court lies awake at night worrying about. I do think, however, that the five justices on this court, or at least four, lie awake worrying at night about states' rights in Arizona immigration. I think there was an immigration case last year that quite clearly signaled that the Supreme Court believes the argument that if Congress isn't going to do anything, the states should do something. And there is language in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in that case suggesting that he is very sympathetic to Arizona's claim that the federal government did nothing for many years and Arizona is well within its rights to set its own immigration policy. I think that there are four justices on this court who care deeply about affirmative action and doing away with affirmative action. Again, the Chief Justice wrote a really seminal case a few years ago about the Seattle schools, saying, as you may recall, the best way to get beyond race is to get beyond race. He doesn't like race-conscious choices in any forum, and I think it's fair to say that the Texas case could be the vehicle to do away with affirmative action. I think that there are four votes on this court. I may be wrong. I think there are four votes and maybe five to legalize gay marriage. I really do. And I think that if you look at what the Ninth Circuit did yesterday, it was clearly written in a way that would be appealing to Justice Kennedy, that fifth vote, to appeal to his concerns that he has. Now, remember, he's considered quite a conservative justice, but he has been the voice of gay rights at the U.S. Supreme Court for the last several decades. And if you read the case as it came down yesterday, written, by the way, by Stephen Reinhart, the most liberal judge on the federal appeals courts, it was written in such a way as to appeal, I think, to Justice Kennedy to be that fifth vote for gay marriage. So, where does this leave us? I think it leaves us with the court. Oh, and the Voting Rights Act. I think there's no question that the court is ready to do away with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. There are 5 votes to do that. They ducked it in a Texas case a few years ago. They ducked it again last month. But I do think that the days of the Voting Rights Act are numbered. You'll notice that the one hot-button issue I haven't talked about today is abortion. There isn't, in fact, an abortion case coming up the pipeline to the court for all sorts of interesting reasons we can talk about later. But I want to conclude my prepared remarks by just saying that it seems to me that the court has a real challenge in the coming month, which is to signal to the world that it really is a postpartisan or nonpartisan institution that doesn't divide 5-4 on ideological issues, and yet it is going to confront, I would submit, at least 5, but up to 7 in the next 2 years, hot-button ideological issues. And it has to figure out a way to thread that needle, and it is going to be a very complicated prospect. I think if I were a betting woman, I would say that the court will uphold the Health Care Act for some of the reasons I've suggested. I think it may strike down, I think it will uphold the Arizona immigration law. And I think it will, down the road, uphold gay marriage. But I think these are going to be 5-4 votes, and the court is going to have to do a lot of dancing to explain why it's not a partisan institution when it does so. The paradox here underlying everything I've said is that we have a very strange court right now. We have a court that's quite evenly divided between 4 liberals, 4 conservatives, and Justice Kennedy, who does whatever he wants to do. And it is an incredibly fraught problem. You could really see it coming out in the Prop 8 opinion yesterday, when every lawyer in America is trying to ask themselves, what would Kennedy do? And that is the determinant of both litigation strategy and those of us who are watching the healthcare cases trying to get into that sweet spot in Justice Kennedy's lizard brain and figure out what kinds of arguments appeal to him and what doesn't. And let me tell you, after 12 years, that way madness lies. So I want to just close by saying that the one valence that is layered over everything I have told you about how incredibly complicated it is for the court to hold itself out. You'll remember in the Chief Justice's parlance, we're just umpires. We're neutral umpires. Balls and strikes. Clarence Thomas's locution at his confirmation hearing. The day you get on the bench, you strip down like runners. You're just, who you were is inconsequential. What matters is judging the cases. But, you know, on the left side of the bench, we hear Elena Kagan say, it's law all the way down. It's always law. There's nothing else. There's just law. And I'm not even going to remind you, because I still have post-traumatic stress disorder, of what happens when you suggest that wise Latina women come to different conclusions than non-wise, non-Latina men. So it is a really difficult problem that the court has constructed for itself, which is to suggest that they are oracular beings who do something that is not politics, where they have so deeply entrenched themselves in the political life of this country. And so the valence I wanted to add to my remarks is just to remind you that in the midst of all that, you have justices behaving badly on both sides. You have Clarence Thomas and Justice Scalia going to secret Koch brothers events where they're planning the downfall of the Obama administration. You have Elena Kagan up to her ears in litigation strategy for the healthcare cases, but declining to take herself off the case. You have justices across the spectrum speaking out on issues they should not be speaking about. Justices across the spectrum giving speeches at places they should not be speaking. And really a different media world that I think they don't understand, in much the manner that they don't understand pagers, where it is as simple as having a guy with a camera phone and you are caught out doing something inappropriate. And the justices, I think, have simply not adjusted their reality to that fact. And so it seems to me that the easiest fix for everything I'm talking about today, a deeply entrenched court that is having to solve insoluble political problems on which the electorate are split 50-50, that the two simple fixes are, one, behave better. Conduct yourself. The judicial canons are very clear. Conduct yourself better. than everyone else. It does not make for fun Christmas parties. It does not make for drunken, you know, carousing with your buddies. But it means that people have faith in the integrity of the institution. And I think the justices have not all held themselves to that standard. And my second suggestion, which is, I know, extremely controversial, is roll television cameras into the court, is allow oral argument to be televised. Because having covered the court for 12 years, I can tell you this with 100% certainty. This is an extraordinary body. They work so hard. They are in good faith most of the time. What they are doing is not log rolling and horse trading in the manner of Congress. And if Americans could see how hard they work and how good they are at their jobs, I think that some of the sense that the court is pure politics all the time would be diminished. Now, I know there are risks. The risks are called Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. I understand that the court does not want to be the object of ridicule, but I do think at the end of the day, it's better to be the object of a little bit of mild ridicule than to be really held in contempt by the American people for being a partisan political institution. So I've talked longer than I said I would, and I'm happy to take your questions, but I thank you so much for indulging me this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dahlia. And would you believe she said at least half of that standing on her toes, maybe more. So now we do have time for the questions, but I want to say that I'd like to remind you that this is a question period, not a time for any kind of statements. So I'm going to just have to cut people short if they get up to make a statement. So please raise your hands for the questions. And okay, over there first.
I will make a statement. What a fantastic speech. Thank you. But my question, you talked about Citizens United, and you said they were surprised by the blowback and had been managing it since then. Could you give us examples of that?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that was so interesting about the way Citizens United played out was, you may recall, it came up twice. It came up as a tiny little inconsequential case about something called Hillary the Movie that was supposed to be played on HBO. The court ordered that it be rebriefed, right? And in the rebriefing, they said, oh, by the way, can you just tell us if we should overrule a couple hundred years of campaign law? So it was clear to those of us watching that it was going to be a big deal, and that the court had actually functionally done away with sections of McCain-Feingold that were at issue already. And so I think that the court had a feeling, two things. One was that it wouldn't be a big deal. They did not anticipate super PACs. They did not anticipate Sheldon Adelson. They did not expect what was going to happen this fall was going to happen. They should have. If you go back and read Justice Kennedy's opinion, it's quite naive about what was going to happen. But the other thing I think they didn't anticipate, and this is the most interesting part of the case to me, all the free speech groups were on the side of the corporate interests in this case. So we like to think that Citizens United was a big guy versus little guy, David versus Goliath. My constitutional law professor, Kathleen Sullivan, and Lawrence Tribe and Floyd Abrams were all on the side of Citizens United. So it's really important that the court looked at this as a pure speech case. They thought all the liberals are on the side of more speech. They had no idea that it would turn into not just Citizens United as we see it today and super PACs as they've played out. I think they really thought they were going to make liberals very happy with you know, such a robust speech protective decision. And I think that the best example I can give for why I think they were taken off guard completely was President Obama's comments at the State of the Union when he got up there and query whether that was a wise choice to invite the court to sit, you know, where you all are sitting now and then just spank them. I wouldn't have done it, but it's been done. FDR's done it. Reagan's done it. But he did do it. And there we have poor Justice Sam Alito mouthing in perfectly audible television, "That's not true." He was absolutely shocked that the president was going to take him to task. And I think, one, I think Alito had no idea who was going to be captured on television, or that was going to be, which is another reason to have televisions in the court, right? If we had televisions in the court, they would get used to the idea that people are watching them. But more profoundly, I think, that complete visceral reaction by Justice Alito, that everything that Obama had said in his characterization of Citizens United was a lie, to me really highlights the ways that they did not anticipate the huge public outcry, the visceral public reaction. The polling after Citizens United in the 2 weeks after suggested that 80% of Americans hated that decision. Those numbers 2 years later have not changed. And I really think that the court thought, it's a speech case, and we kind of all hate McCain-Feingold, we know it doesn't work, and what's the big deal? I think the big deal, again, is super PACs and Stephen Colbert. But the court didn't know either of those two things were going to happen, and I think they have been really, really surprised by the reaction.
I've forgotten from my political science classes, is there an age limit or term limit that justices serve?
I'm so glad you asked that. Justices serve for, the question is there an age limit or a term limit? Justices serve for life, barring bad behavior, and that's really bad behavior. So one of the things that's really interesting that I meant to mention in my opening remarks is that three of the sitting justices will be 80 by 2016, by the end of Obama's second term, or Mitt Romney, or I guess now Rick Santorum's first term. So this is a very much an aging court, and one of the issues that we really do need to think about going into the election, which we never think about, is the composition of the court, because one of those three justices who's going to be, I think, retiring fairly soon is Justice Kennedy, who's right at the middle. And if you think you've seen ugly, partisan, borky hearings before, I guarantee you that the hearing for whoever the unfortunate soul is that has to replace Anthony Kennedy will be the most unpleasant thing you've ever seen, because that spot on the court, that's it. The whole court pivots on that, on replacing that person. The final thing I would just say is there has been some momentum in the legal academy to try to impose term limits on the justices and to do other things, because we now have what we had never anticipated. The framers wrote a constitution assuming that people lived to, like, what, 18? They just didn't expect that people would serve for 30, 40, 50 years. And what we've been doing is not simply, you know, thank God people live longer. John Paul Stevens is 91 and retired last year. But that we put people on the court in their 40s quite deliberately so they can be there forever. So I think there has been some groundswell of interest in doing something, acknowledging the fact that, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years maybe, but 50, really? But I don't think, you know, because it's in the Constitution, I don't think unless the justices choose to impose this on themselves, I don't think it gets changed.
You mentioned Scalia and Thomas sort of slipping off to secret meetings with the Koch brother billionaires, which is something that certainly disturbed me to read about. What sort of restraints are there on judicial behavior, and what do you think there should be?
Usually that's the first question I get asked. For the past 2 years, that's always been the first question. So good for you all for waiting till number three. It's a huge problem. I mean, the simple answer is that there are ethics rules that apply to all federal judges. Federal district and appeals courts judges are bound by all sorts of rules that are very complicated, but the upshot is that they bar against what's called the appearance of impropriety. So the standard isn't, are you behaving improperly? the standard is, would you think that they are behaving improperly? It's an extremely high standard. Some of us would suggest it's a fair price to pay for lifetime tenure and a cushy federal salary and only hearing 70 cases a year. But that's the standard. The problem is the ethics rules do not apply to the Supreme Court justices. They apply mandatorily to every other federal judge. They do not apply at the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Roberts, I will give him huge credit, devoted his State of the Judiciary speech this January, a speech that sinks like a stone on New Year's, but he nevertheless did it, and he devoted it to this problem. Now, his answer was incredibly dissatisfying to people who are worried about judicial conduct, because what he said, in effect, was, he didn't name Clarence Thomas or Elena Kagan, but what he said is, I trust my colleagues. I think they have good judgment. If you knew them the way I knew them, you would know that they're not in any way compromised. That's not an answer, obviously. The answer has to either be that the judges take it upon themselves to bind themselves by the code, or, and I think this is almost more important, you know, their arguments for not doing it, and I want to be clear, this isn't a right-left problem. One of the most eloquent people who has spoken about why we cannot make the code mandatory for the Supreme Court has been Stephen Breyer. And what he says is this: if someone gets bumped off a federal appeals court case, you bring someone else in. If someone gets bumped off the Supreme Court, you have 4-4 ties, and that doesn't work for anyone. Now, there are two solutions to that. One is, if you look at the unbelievable number of cases last year in which Elena Kagan had to recuse herself because she had been the Solicitor General, there was still only one 4-4 tie. It doesn't happen nearly as often as we think. But there is a proposal afoot, and I think it's not a terrible one, that we just so happen to have three former Supreme Court justices ambling around the country, and that it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to tap Sandra Day O'Connor, John Paul Stevens, or David Souter for those situations where someone has to be recused from a case. There's no reason not to, other than I think David Souter cannot be prized from his country house in New Hampshire ever again. But I think certainly the other two would be delighted to serve, and I think it solves that problem. But more urgently, I mean, under your question, I think the really important thing to think about is that only 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the Supreme Court heard a case called Caperton. And you may remember it, it's not only a West Virginia case, it's also a Grisham novel. And it's about what happens when a state Supreme Court justice is given so much money for his campaign by someone who is then a party in the case before him. And you may recall the most eloquent statement about not bias, but the appearance of bias, comes out of the court in a 5-4 decision in Caperton, where they say it is so important. The only thing the judiciary has is public confidence. And if we destroy that, if we diminish that, it destroys the integrity of the judiciary. So how is it possible that the same court that wrote that Caperton decision, that said, even if you're not compromised by taking multi-millions of dollars from somebody who then is a party in your case, it looks bad. And when a court says that and then doesn't apply that standard to themselves, it suggests to me that, you know, the famous, if you operate on yourself, you have a fool for a doctor, that the people who are the least well situated to be making ethics decisions about themselves are the people who are, in fact, subject to ethics inquiries. And so I just think we need to figure out a way to help the justices understand that for them to make these decisions and then reassure us that nothing to see here is not working. They understand it in a West Virginia Supreme Court jurist, but not when it applies to themselves.
Is it? Oh. I don't think I heard you mention DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. My understanding is there's a series of appeals cases coming up out of New England, I think it is, and the Obama administration has refused to defend the act, which it normally would do through a solicitor general, has refused and has declared the act unconstitutional. What do you think is going to happen? Is that going to be merged with the California case, or is it going to be on its own, and what would be the consequences?
I mentioned it only insofar as I think there is a general feeling that the DOMA cases, the Defense of Marriage Act cases, are in a foot race with Prop 8 to get to the court first, and that the DOMA cases were always seen by the gay marriage community as a better vehicle to test these principles in front of the court. That's why they were so angry when Ted Olson and David Boies sort of helicoptered in to bring the Prop 8 challenge, because the DOMA case involves slightly different issues, but I think the argument was they're more compelling issues if you really wanted to bring Justice Kennedy on board. There is one case that is being briefed and argued now at the First Circuit. There's a case coming up from New York that is a challenge to the DOMA. It is absolutely true that the Obama administration for the first 2 years defended the constitutionality of DOMA and then reversed themselves. Eric Holder said, "We can't defend this. It's unconstitutional." Paul Clement, this is a part of the story I should tell. Paul Clement is like the Where's Waldo of every case I've told you. Paul Clement is the most extraordinary oral advocate I have ever seen. He was the last Solicitor General in the Bush administration. I think he's 48, if that. He is defending the DOMA cases, the healthcare cases, the Arizona cases, the Section 5 Voting Rights Act case. He is, every single case that I have mentioned today has Paul Clement as their lawyer. And it might seem to you like it's not a fair fight to have one guy representing every one of those interests, but you know what? He's still the best lawyer I've ever seen. I mean, he is extraordinary. So Congress hired him to represent their interests in the DOMA cases. And I think now we really have an interesting question of, they won't be merged with the Prop 8 cases. The interests are quite different and the issues are quite different. I think there's a question about DOMA, which is, can you strike down an act of Congress, which is what DOMA is, more readily than you can strike down a state referendum? And there's equities on either side there. But more urgently, I think there's a real fight, particularly after yesterday, after the Prop 8 case came down, to determine which of those cases should come up to the court, and more profoundly, which the court might want to take. So I think that those two litigations have been proceeding on separate tracks for several years, and there was always a question of which one was going to get to the court first. I think now the court, ironically, because the Prop 8 decision was so narrow, might have an interest in saying, you know, the Prop 8 decision is so cabined to California and to states where there's been a referendum that maybe they take the DOMA cases because the implications are suddenly huge. Had the Ninth Circuit yesterday announced what we thought they might, that there is a fundamental right to marry under the Due Process Clause, that everyone has a right to marry the partner of their choosing, I think the court would have had to take Prop 8. So one of the things that I think we saw happen yesterday, and I'm not nearly enough of a betting woman to sort of put numbers on these, but I think we saw the Ninth Circuit take themselves out of the game a little bit and to issue an opinion that is quite deliberately sufficiently narrow that the court can ignore it and take the DOMA cases if they want to.
A personal view, the Supreme Court seems to be devolving over the last 30 or 40 years. And I wonder how you would respond to the idea that we used to have justices who had more than a legal background, that had backgrounds that came from a lot. You look at Holmes or Brandeis or some of these people, these were philosophers as much as they were lawyers. You look at the Supreme Court today, it's lawyers. And I wonder if that doesn't give us court decisions which are more narrow, more mundane, and less powerful.
A couple of responses. I actually think that three of the best writers in the history of the Supreme Court are sitting on the court right now. I think Justice Scalia, agree with him or not, is one of the most powerful writers I've ever seen. The Chief Justice is an extraordinarily gifted legal writer. And surprise, surprise, Elena Kagan is proving to be an exceptional legal writer. And if you do nothing else when you go home, go back and read her Arizona campaign finance dissent from last year. It is a barnstormer. So I don't think it's entirely fair to say they don't write well. I completely agree on the predicate of the question, which is this court is the first court in history that doesn't have a single politician on it. The last person who ran for elected office in the Supreme Court was Sandra Day O'Connor, who served in the Arizona legislature. I don't think it's an accident that her campaign finance votes were quite different than the campaign finance votes you see coming out of the court today, right? She was the linchpin. If she had not left the court, Citizens United would not have happened. And she understood campaign finance. Why? Because she had been in a legislature. And I think it is not an accident that what we're seeing, it's not just that they're lawyers, it's that they're law professors. They're all coming out of the academy. It is certainly, I don't think, would surprise anyone who's come out of the academy that opinions have grown exponentially in length. The court used to dispose of things in three or four pages. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages get poured into legal opinions now. Now, maybe it's because issues are hundreds and hundreds of pages more complicated, or maybe it's because the academy teaches you to use a lot of words. But I do think that that is a huge problem. So there's both that there's nobody who's run for office, that these folks come out of an academic background. And I think that what I see, my version of the problem you're describing, is that the court has become, I don't want to say devolved. I think you have to be really careful. Go back and read. There's an amazing book called Scorpions by Jeff Schessel, who writes about the FDR, all the FDR appointments. And you really feel like you need to shower after you read that book. I mean, the ways that Hugo Black and Robert Jackson and William O. Douglas were going after each other in the press, they were quite contemptible, the way they conducted themselves. So I think it's a little dangerous to say there were these halcyon days where the justices comported themselves judicially, where they were, you know, whispering to reporters that, you know, people were compromised in cases. I do think there is one difference. The nine justices on the Supreme Court today come out of two schools. Their clerks come out of five schools, all of them. I mean, with a handful of exceptions. They're taking all their clerks from five schools, from six feeder judges. The building has contracted so that the entire building maps almost perfectly onto the Harvard or Yale faculty club. That's the scary thing. It's not just their jobs. I think when we talk about, oh, they didn't have good judicial jobs, that's shorthanding a deeper problem, which is that they just don't have life experience. There's not a single person after Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who will be 81 next year, once she leaves the court, there will not be a single person who litigated civil rights cases on this court that decides seminal civil rights cases. There is not a defense attorney on this court. There are almost nobody on this court. To the extent that they had any legal background, they all worked for a president. So this is not representative both of the legal world in general, it's not representative of their caseload, and it's not representative of the kinds of issues they have to decide. So that's the contraction that scares me. And the best example I can give, just because it's funny, is in my second year covering the court, I remember the court was deciding a Fourth Amendment case about whether you had an expectation of privacy in your bags that were up on the overhead rack on a Greyhound bus. So the question is, what can immigration officials come in and squeeze your bags, or do they have to get your consent? What do people think in terms of their expectation of privacy on a Greyhound bus? So let me ask you, how many of the nine justices do you think travel around on a Greyhound bus? 'Cause I'm going to say none. And it was extraordinary watching them try to sort of muddle through this. And I'm not saying all nine of them need to take Greyhounds. And Chief Justice Roberts, to his credit, takes the Metro to work every day. But I really do think that unless you have a broad, broad cross-section, not just of jobs, but of schools and life experiences and litigation history and passions and interests, it's not just about gender and race. It's got to be something more. And I do think, just to conclude, that the real problem we have is the confirmation hearings, which have become long, toxic, devastating, and embarrassing, and have led to people who have had any kind of interesting life. You know, forget about smoking a joint one time. Now, it's if you have ever had an unpopular client or written an unappealing word, you're out. And so you are going to get more and more people who look like they were grown hydroponically in an underground lab to someday be on the Supreme Court. And that's, I think, the problem you've put your finger on.
Actually, that was my question. Having watched Thomas's confirmation hearing, Sotomayor's confirmation, what do you see as an alternative to the circus that we see in each confirmation?
I mean, it's a great question. I'll tell you one more funny story, which is that my parents live in Israel. And when I was covering the Roberts confirmation hearing, I got an email from my dad. It said, "Is that you in the blue suit playing solitaire?" He could actually see me on C-SPAN with my screen up, you know, just, he's like, "Please stop it, you look bad." So, oops. This is my dad, who was totally okay when I went on Larry King with a Cheerio in my hair, but he drew the line at unprofessionalism. So the confirmation hearings are terrible. I think that one of the things that Americans don't fully apprehend about those hearings is that these are completely political theater that we know, right? This is nothing. It's a big show. But that the judges who get funneled into that machine, into that wood chipper, they have no experience with cameras. For all the reasons we just talked about, they're not elected politicians. If they've ever been on television before in their lives, you know, it was once in a fawning local profile. They have no resources to go into a room and be called a racist and a bigot and a man-hater and all the, you know, financially compromised and all the other things we use to condemn them. And so we've constructed this whole elaborate show that is about demonizing and vilifying them, but no one lets them in on the joke. Right? That this doesn't matter. No one believes this. If you watch for 5 minutes, Chuck Schumer can be screaming at Orrin Hatch, but then they walk, the Klieg lights go off, and they walk off arm in arm, because this is hilarious for them. They don't think you're really a bigot. They don't think you hate white men, Judge Sotomayor. We're just saying that. So I think that really, really, you end up not with just a process that is deeply humiliating for these judges. But I think, and I'm becoming more and more convinced of this, that it's the reason that judges hate television cameras. I think that there is, you can draw a straight line between how they are treated at their hearings and why they are terrified to allow cameras into oral argument, because they really think the object of cameras is to humiliate them. So it seems to me there are very real consequences. I would even go further and say, if you look at their opinions that they've been writing in the past couple of years about the internet and about publicity in general, if you look at the Phelps funeral protest case, all of that anxiety about angry mobs, I think, maps pretty directly onto the experiences they had at their hearings. So I think what I want to say is I agree. The hearings are awful. They humiliate the justices and, I think, seal in amber for the American public an image of the justices that is not true. So that when you ask people, is Clarence Thomas the guy that I saw at his hearings, he's really not. He's nothing like that. But no one will ever know that. No one will ever know that Sam Alito is not the sort of surly, grumpy man whose wife ran out of the hearing in tears. Because we get this idea that's the last time we see them, and I think that's dangerous. But third, and I think most importantly, I really think it's beginning to inflect on First Amendment doctrine. I think it's starting to leach into the ways they write about the media, the press, and technology, and that really is dangerous if it's happening. And so how would I fix it? I would fix it by going back to what they did until very recently, which is confirm them on paper, until Frankfurter and Brandeis, who had to go to their own hearings because they were Jews. Nobody went to their own hearings. William O. Douglas begged to be allowed into his own hearing, and nobody wanted to hear from him. So until very recently, they did it on your record. You didn't show up. If you showed up at all, and Justice Stevens talks very eloquently about this, you were there for 2 hours, for a day. It was over. But what we have now is this grueling 5-day marathon that, with the exception of Elena Kagan, who I think really, for whatever reason, had the temperament to get through it. You know, it was like one of those spanking machines and she didn't care. But I think with the exception of Kagan, the four that I have covered, so that would be the chief, Alito, and Sotomayor, I think are really, really damaged by theirs. And that's the part that I worry about. And it maps back onto what we talked about. When you have a court that is completely insulated itself and then has really developed a mentality that says, and this is the most emblematic example of this, is locking the front doors of the court, which happened 2 years ago, where they sealed up those ceremonial doors that say equal justice under the law. I think when the court is barring access to the building, that, I think, has something to do with both your point and your point about the court shrinking in on itself, but also I think the court becoming terrified of what they see as the angry mob that is us. So the question was, do I see an alternative? I really think the alternative is two things. One, I think the court can fix some of this again by allowing cameras in. I think it's a huge mistake to let the American public see the job interview and not the job, because the job interview is embarrassing and the job is extraordinary. So I really do think the court could correct a lot of the damage by letting folks see oral argument. That's an easy fix. I think the harder fix is for Congress to realize that they are really imperiling the integrity and the esteem of the court by what they're doing, and to say, you know what, we're just going to make an agreement. We're going to go back to doing this on paper. We're going to do it in 2 days. We're not going to ask the same question 16 times. We're going to collude with one another in the Senate so that we don't ask the same question 16 times. This thing is done after the first day. The extra 4 days are, trust me, for the person who is running around, this is an overshare, trying to figure out where to plug her breast pump in the Dirksen building. Those extra 4 days are simply empty theater. There is no reason whatsoever for it. And so I think if everyone would just understand that it makes the court look bad, it makes the Senate look bad, and it makes the nominee look bad, no one benefits from this arrangement, I think they could make a decision to be better. But
could you describe your life as a court reporter a little bit? Are you at every oral argument?
So the question is, what's life like as a Supreme Court reporter? One of the things that's great about living in Charlottesville is I don't go to all the arguments anymore, and that's one of the things that's great about having little children. I used to go to a lot more. One day when I was heading into an argument, my husband texted me a photo of my then 3-year-old with a huge black eye here in Charlottesville, and it said, "Do you think he needs to go to the ER?" So it's hard to drive for 2.5 hours when your kids are here. So I have, quite frankly, gone less. I probably cover about 20 of the 70 cases a year. It's a great, amazing, fantastic job that is made much harder by the court because they won't let you use recorders of any sort. You can't take in a tape recorder. We've all been in this existential struggle with the court to, at the very least, release audio tapes, which are made every day, but they don't release them so that we could do our jobs better. The court, you know, in this theme of self-protection and controlling its image, is very, very reluctant to accredit people to cover the court, and they make it very hard for us to cover the court. You are not allowed, you as the audience, until 2 years ago, were not allowed to bring a pen and paper into into the chamber. You are now allowed to bring in a pen and paper. I am not allowed to bring in a book. I am allowed to bring in a pen and paper. I once stupidly brought in a copy of Kafka's The Trial. And then got into this big argument with the marshal about irony. And do they really want to confiscate my copy of The Trial? Which they did. Chief Justice Rehnquist famously had Nina Totenberg's intern, who was wearing a headscarf, take her headscarf off, sent a marshal over in the middle of oral argument, told her to take her scarf off. It was distracting him. So there is a lot of weird between the court and the press for some of the reasons we've talked about. I think by and large it's the best job in the world. It is certainly the case that nobody has ever in my career there told me I can't write something. I think when you write something that upsets the justices, you find out. Often because you're moved from row 3 to row 7. But by and large, I think it's an amazing job. And, you know, I'm talking with some frustration about some of the court's choices, but I really think there's a reason that approval ratings for Congress and the executive branch are so low and approval ratings for the court are pretty high. It's a pretty singular institution that does its job, you know, by and large, really, really well. And it's a privilege. I probably should have said this at the beginning, to cover an institution that still puts a premium on civility, that still puts a premium on talking politely to one another, on giving one another the benefit of the doubt. So in all those ways, it's a fantastic job. I think I do feel like the court is in the midst of a pretty existential struggle about how to present itself in a world of new media, in a world of cable, in a world where they used to be able to do everything in private and now they are caught out for everything. And I think they are reacting in the wrong ways. So it's just a really interesting moment to be part of that. But I wouldn't change a thing.
Looking to the future, I'd like to ask you to speculate on how soon the court will be hearing issues of the recent latter-day Jim Crow laws that, as far as voting rights, which are being limited to particularly destitute students and so forth, as far as in some of the states, Florida, some of the Midwestern states. I don't know if there are any courts, any cases moving through the courts right now, and I know Holder that is looking into it, but I just wondered what you'd have to say about it.
I mean, there are cases moving through the courts. There are challenges. But in one of the more disappointing decisions that's come down from the Roberts Court, Justice Stevens voted to uphold a pretty punitive voting rights regime and did it even in the face of, you know, admitting that there isn't a lot of vote fraud. This is something of, a solution in search of a problem and that it's awfully hard to get dead people to vote. There is a huge voter registration fraud problem in this country, but it doesn't manifest as vote fraud. And so you have a not problem and a quite draconian solution. And I think when this case came up to the court, people thought that there would be more outrage. And we had Justice Stevens citing to, you know, mob bosses in old New York as his examples of, you know, the most recent, you know, examples of vote fraud from 200 years ago. So I think it is a huge problem. I think that it does have a very, very high priority in the Obama Justice Department. I think that the Justice Department has made the determination that vote fraud is going to be an issue on which they will fight, and they have challenged several of the regimes, and they've been, Eric Holder's been incredibly outspoken about, you know, how this is the new Jim Crow. So I think, you know, this is a priority for this Justice Department. But I think that certainly, you know, the court had an opportunity to strike down a voter ID regime and chose not to.
Before they vote on any more technology, is there any case of bringing in an expert to teach them something?
That's a great question. I mean, I do think that I was heartened by how well they understood the GPS case. I think that there was a feeling after the pager case a few years ago, and there was a garage door patent case that was equally dismal, where people thought, oh my God, how can they come out here and not know this? You know, one of the things that has changed at the court in the last couple of years is that the justices are all on computers. They brag about their Kindles. Justice Scalia brags about listening to opera on his iPod. So I do think that where, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, there was this sense that they were fetishizing the fact that they didn't understand technology, I think they are getting there. And I think it really, here you do see a difference between Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, who kind of grew up with technology and who, you know, have clerks who are really eager to teach them, and some of the older justices who just want, you know, there's famous stories about David Souter, who was so opposed to technology that when he was given a television for his birthday, it sat in his living room as like a plant stand, but he never, ever plugged it in. And, you know, Souter's clerks describe death penalty cases where they were trying to call him, and there was a stay, and there was an hour, and it was Alabama. And David Souter didn't have an answering machine or, you know, call waiting. And if he just accidentally put the old-timey phone down on the counter and was scrubbing potatoes in his farmhouse in New Hampshire, they just couldn't reach him. So, you know, those days I think are ending. I think that the justices are much more aware of, you know, what's going on in the world. But, you know, I do think that they're terrified by it. I think that that it's a mixed blessing. And some of the rhetoric that I saw both in the GPS case and last year in the Phelps funeral protest case, I mean, the interesting part of that case wasn't the funeral protesters. We all think it was that, you know, Fred Phelps and his despicable minions are, you know, protesting funerals. But what was interesting about that case and what kind of fell out of the case was the web component of that case. There was an awful epic poem that they put up, and there was a television component. All that falls out of the case by the time the court gets it. But if you look at the way they're talking about it, if you're listening to Stephen Breyer talk about maybe we should do away with the fire in a crowded theater test because the whole world, television and the internet, have turned the whole world into a crowded theater, maybe we just shouldn't have a First Amendment at all. You just get this visceral sense that they are afraid, that they feel technology is part of this mob that's pressing in on them. So I think one of the things we need to teach them is both that, you know, it's there, it's ubiquitous, it's scary, but that we have to deal with it, and that, you know, you can't shut it off. And that's a really hard thing, I think, to teach them. How about we take one more?
I last year read a biography of Justice Brennan, and I learned a heck of a lot about the court. And I think what I learned most was how much time and energy is put into reading and writing. You talked about all the words written, but they do read a lot. It's not what you hear or see when they're questioning the different attorneys. That's really just sort of a culmination of some of their reading. And their writing, and I mean, here's Justice Brennan, who rode his bike to work. And so my question is, do you think that we all look at it as just the hearing, or do we realize there's that much going on in the background?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the hearing is the public part of it, because everything else is done secretly. And the really interesting thing about the court that I think people don't understand is that the court isn't nine justices who are deeply connected and bonded with one another. It is frequently described perfectly accurately as nine completely separate law firms that happen to be housed in the same building. But the idea that the justices are all lunching together and then golfing together, it is true that Justice Scalia and Justice Kagan go shooting together more than once. But by and large, this is not an aggregation of nine people working together. They communicate by way of memos. They have occasional lunches and dinners together, but very few. There conferences where they discuss cases are completely confidential. Clerks are not allowed. Secretaries are not allowed. The most junior justices for 16 years, this is Stephen Breyer, have to leap up and answer the door when there's a knock at the door. They're like the little serf at the conferences. And so that's Kagan's job for the foreseeable future. But nobody can come in there. It is so secret what happens at conference that justices' conference notes are held for decades, as Brennan's were in that case, so that nobody knows what deliberations were, what was said and what happened. So I think that oral argument becomes so fundamental to our perception of what the court's doing because it's the only part of their work that they do in public. And I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that right now oral argument is so overheated. The justices talk so much. Advocates are supposed to stand at the lectern and look up and say, may it please the court, before they begin. And now it's turned into may it, and then it goes. They can't even answer questions. There are questions that are, you know, Justice Breyer will ask a question, Justice Kagan will tag in, the Chief Justice will ask something, and Sotomayor will ask something, and the advocate has yet to say a word. And so it's considered a very hot bench right now. And so for me, this part of the theater is critically important because it's the only thing that we see and everything else is so secretive. But you're completely right. The justices are phenomenally well prepared. They get stacks of briefs. They get amicus briefs over and above their briefs. They read them all, and they come in just phenomenally well prepared. I think I dispute, the only thing I would dispute in your question is that I think it is not a foregone conclusion what's going to happen before oral argument. I think that most justices would tell you a good oral argument will never win a case, but a bad one will lose a case. And that when you have a bad oral argument, someone who gets up and does a dismal job, you can see votes flip. I suspect that, just to end where I began, Seth Waxman pointing out all the buttocks on the interior of the chamber in the FCC fleeting expletives case may have, in fact, lost him that case. Don't call your bookies, but that's just my suggestion that it looked rude and disrespectful, and I think that the court wanted no part of that. So I do think that things can happen at oral argument that absolutely change outcomes. You have been so generous with your time. I thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.